making good. I'm Renee Blanchard, founder and operator of Church Alley Cafe and Grocery, located here in New Orleans, Louisiana. Church Alley is a people-first, mission-driven small business that I opened in 2013. And the best part about owning a cafe is the people. So in this podcast, I interview the makers, the farmers, and the many interesting people I've met through the shops, the folks doing the good work here in Louisiana and all along the Gulf Coast. Let's get started.
Hi, y'all. My name is Leah Porsche. I'm a registered dietitian in South Louisiana. I live in Houma, and it's actually an area called Bayou Du Large. We are almost like 20 minutes from the Gulf of Mexico. So essentially, we're like below New Orleans, way down south. I work right now in private practice. And what that looks like for me is I'm actually contracted to Early Steps. It's an early intervention program. And I work with kids who are 0 to 3 years old, and they have either a medical diagnosis or some kind of developmental delay, something where they require some extra support and meeting milestones where typical kids would, you know, meet those on their own. I also have a blog called On the Food Side. I tend to mostly share recipes through that. I really like to cook. I really like to offer food as like a friend in the journey of living, rather than being something to be feared or always fighting with. And that goes alongside with my views as a dietitian. So I work in intuitive eating. I work with a health at every size informed approach, which is basically saying that, you know, health is about more than just your body size. And then I'm also a yoga teacher, and I have a huge personal interest in body image and working with people to kind of work on their body image, finding the right relationship that works for them in whatever the situation may be. So not necessarily looking for body love, but, you know, how do you want to feel about your body? That's kind of my angle. I think that I covered most of it.
Well, thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate it. And so we met just a few weeks ago on the Nichols campus. You were teaching a culinary medicine class within the culinary medicine program that one of my teachers, Mrs. Gobert, is doing. And so you talked to this, and you specifically talked about health at every size. So you went to Nichols. So you also graduated from Nichols from that program and keep getting asked to like do these culinary medicine classes as well over the years. And you also went back to school. So this was like your second career kind of thing.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So how did you go? And you were in restaurants before.
Right.
In the kitchen, right? And so how did you go from restaurants to deciding you wanted to go back to school like that?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely had a very non-traditional route. Initially, when I was in college, when I was 17, I wanted to be a doctor at that time, but just the coursework and the costs was just, it didn't look like the right path. So I had actually switched to general studies and was just kind of waiting to figure out what I wanted to do. I was in restaurants. I worked in the service side for the most part, but moved up through like bartending, management, working in the kitchen, doing things like that. And one of the jobs I had, because I worked in a restaurant, I wanted another part-time job. And I was always interested in fitness. I've played sports my whole life. My parents were, you know, crunchy people. So we kind of had that, you know, whole food kind of lifestyle growing up. So I worked in a gym. I got a job in a gym. It gave me a free gym pass, which was, you know, great. Yeah. And the hours worked, you know, with the restaurant hours. So they kind of complemented each other. And there was a point where I was paying for college by working my jobs, and my car that I had broke down. So I couldn't afford that car anymore. So I had to like quit for a while. So I just stopped going to college, was working full time, still trying to figure out my path, what I wanted to do. And I actually found out about a grant program to become an EMT. And I was like, okay, so this is medical. I like that. You know, it was kind of keeping me in the same field. I finished the program, became an EMT, and did not love it. And one of my mentors said, if you don't love it now, you're not going to love it, you know, 5 years down the road. Yeah. So you might want to think about doing something different. So I went back into restaurants and the gym, and reading like nutrition and health magazines. That was like one of my favorite things to do at work. And I saw this, you know, job description about a dietitian. And I'm like, there's a job where people like get coached in what to eat and what's healthy. And like, that's a real job. I didn't even know that.
Yeah.
So I called Nichols and found out about the program. At that time, it wasn't feasible for me because we have to do that 1 year internship of, you know, unpaid work. And I just was, it just seemed impossible. Like between the cost of college and the cost of that, it just didn't seem possible. So I kind of tabled the idea. And I ended up actually, you know, kind of moving through life and got pregnant. And I had my daughter. And with that, I got that Pell Grant, which was something that wasn't available to me before. And I was like, well, I'm going to go back to school because I can get support, you know, and have financial aid. And having a daughter, I wanted to like, let me go finish my degree. Let me, you know, finish what I started. And dietetics, like, it just felt like the most right thing for me. And I loved it. It was tough having a child, you know, while you're in school, and especially that internship, that was a struggle. Nichols didn't have their internship yet. So at that time, I went to Southern University in Baton Rouge. And because I had a family here in Houma, I drove every day.
Oh my God.
Baton Rouge. Yes. That was a tough time.
How long did that take?
It was a 10-month program.
Okay, 10-month
program. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, it was tough, but I mean, worth it. It got me where I am now. So, you know, I'm glad I stuck to it. But yeah, it definitely wasn't an easy process.
While you were in school, what was your vision of how you would use that degree? What were you trying to do?
I mean, so, you know, looking back at who I was back then, I definitely had this idea that being a dietitian was going to be the way that I was going to make sure I was healthy and fit, and I was going to help other people be healthy and fit. And so in that definition, it was, you know, about finding the people who had, whether like it was a medical diagnosis or they wanted to lose weight, whatever their goals were, that I would be the one to support them in that and help them, you know, figure it out. We were going to figure that out. And I can remember at that time, it was during like The Biggest Loser was still on TV.
Right.
Definitely an avid fan of that. I was very much into breastfeeding support. Like that was something I wanted to do too. And my research was on weight loss and breastfeeding and future outcomes, you know, related to obesity. Like I was very much in the weight management side of things.
Yeah. So you finished so the way that dietetics degree or the way to become a registered dietitian is that you go to undergrad, you get a degree, you go to this year-long unpaid internship that everyone has to do. And then you take a national exam and then you get licensed for that in Louisiana. And then you're like, okay, I'm ready for the world. This is what I'm going to do. So what did you do right after you finished all of this?
My job right out of school was in a psych hospital.
Oh, wow.
That was an interesting experience. It was nice because even though it was, you know, it felt like a very intense situation, it was a small hospital. So we only had 20 beds. So there wasn't a huge patient, you know, turnover. And one of my friends was, you know, really more of a mentor. She had graduated a few years before me. She had the job before me. And so she was very like supportive. And if you need anything, if you have questions, please come to me. And in that job, I was the clinical dietitian, but I was also the dietary manager. So I took care of any, you know, nutrition, medical nutrition therapy that was needed, but also managed the menu, made sure the right people got the right food. And if there were any food allergies or specific needs, that was my job as well.
Okay. And then how did you start hearing or learning about health at every size? Like how did that then, because that is like a very different approach to health than what you were really passionate about.
Right. Right. Yeah. I mean, I definitely kind of did a whole 180 in that. I think, you know, there was a level of transition in my methodology. I can remember telling a friend that, you know, I had a hard time counseling patients who were over, like they were in bigger bodies that, you know, that I didn't want to tell them that they needed to lose weight, that felt uncomfortable to me. But I couldn't really say why. Like, I didn't really understand it at that time. I went on to become a yoga teacher and be co-owner of a juice bar and yoga studio, which is very much central to this like idea of fitness and thinness equating with health and just the, very much within the wellness culture of things. And while in that, I got pregnant for my second daughter and we found out that she had Down syndrome, but also two medical conditions that were pretty scary for us. And so, you know, I was 26 weeks pregnant and I had been, you know, managing my weight. I had been eating the way I'm supposed to eat, you know, all of these things, in quotes for people who aren't. But yeah, so like I was really like focused on that. And after we got our diagnosis and we're dealing with this, you know, potential medical, you know, issue, mm-hmm. I was just in this place of, I can't be worried about that. Like, how can I eat healthy? How can I take care of myself and my baby, but not worry so much about every bite of food? Mm-hmm. And so I just kind of went on a Google search and I found Intuitive Eating, the book. And it just, it was like this amazing light bulb of like, oh, this makes so much more sense. You know, this answers all those questions. This fills in all those gaps I've kind of had. So I read the Intuitive Eating book and that led me to a book. It was called Health at Every Size back when I read it, but there's a new version of it called Body Respect. And it just kind of gave these ideas of like, what if you stayed in the body you're in? What if you look the way you look, but you chose some different options as far as lifestyle? What if you did add some fruits and vegetables? What if you did find a version of movement that you enjoyed? How would that, you know, feel? And then the research that pointed to when you're someone who is in a larger body, but you are also active, you don't smoke, you don't drink, you get enough sleep, you know, you have adequate access to medical care, you're more likely to live a longer life than someone who is in a smaller body who doesn't, you know, necessarily have all of those healthier lifestyle factors.
Yeah, that's been interesting. I've been listening to this podcast, Maintenance Phase. Do you listen to it?
I love Maintenance
Phase. It's so good. And so, yeah. And so they, you know, I don't even know which episode it was. It might've been in the BMI index. Like, I think they did a few episodes at the same time around this. And the science, when Aubrey, one of the co-hosts, was like listing the science of people in bigger bodies as their age, but also that they have, there's so many things that are not necessarily like health-wise that are correlated with bigger bodies that we are like as a culture made to like assume when right. We see someone, yeah, that they have like, you know, she talked about her own health. She was like, I have a lower blood pressure. I have a lower, you know, whatever, you know, all these different things that you would just never assume because of what we're being kind of fed about what people should look like.
Right.
Across race, across ethnicity, across yeah. culture. Mm-hmm. And so can you just talk a little bit more about, so health at every, because I feel like in the last few years, I've seen those words like pop up together a lot in all kinds, in food blogs or in, you know, whatever, all kinds of different things. Can you talk just a little bit more about what that means? Just in like an everyday like situation, you know, like how you choose your food or your exercise or different things like that.
Yeah. I mean, so one of the things I think, you know, originally Health at Every Size was this movement so that people who are at any size knew that it was possible for them to be healthy, that, you know, that their size didn't automatically say, like what you said, that they're not a healthy person. And I think that for most people who live in a bigger body, there is that assumption everywhere they go that people are saying, you know, assuming that they have some either chronic health condition or, you know, one of those, you know, like they just, you know, if you would take their labs, that their labs would, you know, come out outside of normal limits, that kind of thing. Yeah. And it's the hope is that people would understand that you can't make those judgments and that sometimes the stress and the pressure that people are put under in those circumstances of those assumptions is what actually causes more negative outcomes than right. the assumed illnesses. And that's why it's so important to me to keep doing that culinary medicine thing, because even though there's, you know, it's only a handful of doctors every year that are going to hear my, you know, my version of it, hopefully there's, you know, people all around the country kind of disseminating the information in the same way, where even if they don't necessarily like fully buy in and become haze-informed practitioners themselves, at least they have that little seed to where the next time they see somebody who's in a bigger body, they're not going to automatically say, okay, you need to go on a diet. They're going to ask them real questions about their lifestyle, their concerns, their past medical history, things that actually matter more than just their weight. Because at the end of the day, weight is one piece of a, you know, huge spectrum of things that impact our health and our life's quality of life.
Yeah. So that's been one thing that's really interesting, is you hear over and over again, people say that they go to the doctor because they're experiencing, well, I think there's a few things happening when you go to the doctor in a bigger body, right? Like one is that even when you're not in a bigger body, you don't, they don't know what your association with seeing your weight does to you emotionally or mentally. And that is the first question that gets asked is, okay, let's weigh. And it's like, I'm here for birth control. Like, right. Like I'm here for whatever, like that has nothing to do with weight today. We're not talking about that, but that is the first question. And that, I don't, maybe it was someone in our class, I guess in that class was talking about that, like that raises their blood pressure so high that the right, the next thing that you do is sit in that little room and get your blood pressure
tested. Right.
And so that is impacting. And then also that there's, or I've heard anecdotally, is that people, doctors will not discuss any other issues. It's just constantly, well, you need to lose 20 pounds. You need to lose 30 pounds.
Yeah.
And then we can discuss why your knee hurts or something right. like that.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I watch Grey's Anatomy.
Yeah.
One of the more recent episodes, they had a little piece of this, which I was really great to see, which was really nice to see, because you know, it showed how people in larger bodies can be dismissed for having a complaint that's very, very real. You know, and even in serious cases, you know, more than just knee pain, people with cancer who are denied care, who are, you know, overlooked, ignored because the doctor just wants them to lose weight, when like a simple test would confirm the fact that they have, you know, a critical illness happening, you know, something really serious that needs more work. And then on the other side of it too, you have people in smaller bodies who might be declared healthy just because they, you know, they look like it. You know, you got a healthy looking body, you're healthy. We don't need to go further, you know? So I think everybody, it does everybody a disservice when those kind of assumptions are made.
Yeah. One thing that I've seen, we were talking a little bit earlier, is that, so I've gone through some health issues in the last few years, and I didn't, my doctors wouldn't test. One, I definitely could not communicate what I thought or knew was going on with my body. Like I had no language for it. I didn't understand it. And so I went, I have a number of friends that are registered dietitians. And so I started talking to her. And so she ordered all these labs and it showed like something was very out of whack. And then I was able to go to my doctor who wouldn't listen to me in the beginning with these labs that my RD had been able to get for me. And that showed, and then she was like, okay, well, let's start scheduling these things. My vitamin D was 9 when it should be like 30, I think, you know what I mean? Things like that, that I had no idea what to find out about that. Can you talk a little bit about like how you can utilize what an RD's consultation to help you in kind of the medical setting, like if you then go to a doctor or talk to them?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, one thing, you know, we were talking about weight before, and that is something that, you know, if a person who gets weight is either triggered in the way that like it raises their blood pressure, their anxiety, or somebody who has a history of disordered eating or eating disorders where their weight might contribute to, you know, disordered eating behaviors, that a dietitian can definitely one coach someone in how to advocate for themselves. I have a piece of paper that I can give my clients to bring to the doctor. And I think almost more importantly, I have a paper or a card you can take when you bring your child to the doctor to ask the doctor not to talk about weight in front of the child. Right. You can talk about, you know, lifestyle factors. You can talk about, maybe, you know, percentages and things like that. But to say in front of a child that they are overweight could really be damaging, or even underweight, you know, it can be really be damaging for them, depending on the circumstances. And then beyond that, you know, when the way I practice, I think, has a lot to do with the fact that I'm also a yoga teacher, and some of the trainings I've taken in trauma-informed yoga and things like that. But learning that if you feel like something is wrong, you have the right as a patient to ask for more, to talk to someone else, to, you know, stand up for yourself and ask for more. And I think like that's just a big thing of, you know, digging deeper if there is a concern that the doctor's not meeting. And I just think in dietetics, we're kind of taught that motivational interviewing. We're taught to, you know, kind of help people find the root of the problem rather than looking for that kind of standard answer, you know. And not to say that that's what all doctors do. It just does seem to happen quite a bit, especially when there are assumptions made about people in larger bodies.
Yeah. I mean, just to get, and also it's just, if you're already not feeling well, that situation is really uncomfortable and you don't know. And then, you know, I also hear a lot that people are just like, well, that's the doctor. So I'm supposed to believe what that person is telling me. And it's not like that's not a good doctor. It's just that they don't necessarily have all the information to make. And one thing that within dietetics is that food is so personal, you know? And so you are what impacts you one day may not impact you another day, or the quantity of it one day may not impact. So I feel like we have those such nuanced conversations that are just about me, you know, and just about my life and my body and that kind of thing, that we can kind of pull some of that conversation in when we go to a doctor as well.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, I don't want to get weighed. And I tell you what, I have never asked them not to weigh me because I get nervous every single time.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't have a problem knowing my personal weight, but I ask not to be weighed as like an act of activism for people who may not feel ready for it, or just to normalize it, that it's okay for people to not get weighed. You know, I don't know how much of a difference it makes, but I feel like it's, you know, kind of doing my part. And I just think that it's important for the people who are the ones who are like, let's get a weight to kind of interrupt, like, why are we getting a weight? What is the purpose? What are we going to do with this information? Because most of the time they don't need that information. There are circumstances like when you're dealing with someone who might have edema, where sudden weight changes is concerning, when you're, you know, muscle wasting, things like that, where, yeah, we want to watch somebody's weight. But for most people to get weighed every single time they go to the doctor, it's not really necessary. I mean, but there is the fact that, you know, the O word, you know what I'm talking about there?
Oh, yeah.
The common term for overweight, obese, those terms, yeah, that are used, that have been, you know, medicalized and stigmatizing. Those things, because they were designated as a disease, are, yeah, now covered by insurance. And when a doctor codes for having talked about your weight, they can bill for that. And so there is drive. Yeah, there is a drive for doctors to have that information and then say something. And they don't have to like go very deep. They can say you should lose 10 to 20 pounds. You should go on a diet. You should try X, Y, and Z supplement. And so that's kind of, I think, kind of along the same lines of some pharmaceutical methods of, you know, getting patients to take certain medications, there are incentives that may not be the most ethical. You know, I'm not saying I've gone deep on that topic, or that's something that I'm, you know, really, I don't know that much about it. I just would think that sometimes those things impact how doctors interact with
the
patients.
The outcomes, yeah. So can you explain BMI a little bit? We always see that, the body mass index, and kind of, because we see it, like I got told it when I was in the doctor, and he actually said, don't worry about it. This doesn't impact you at all.
That's
and
good.
I was like, I did know that.
Yeah, I mean, the BMI was made as, it was basically this one Belgian guy was trying to identify the most average man, Like, that's what he was trying to figure out. What's the size and proportion of an average man? And so he did this work himself as a statistician, as a curiosity experiment. I'm not really sure his whole process, but it was adapted by insurance companies as a way to say, you know, who's somebody we want to cover, who's somebody we don't want to cover. And that since then, it's become kind of this standard of care. And I mean, even the essence of it, way back when, even when I was new to dietetics and I was all about the BMI, I, you know, questioned it because people who are muscular have very high BMIs, you know, but that doesn't necessarily mean they're unhealthy. But we can say people with X BMI are not, they don't qualify for care because their BMI is too high. And so it doesn't really give you a clear picture of someone's health at all. And I think that most things like that, you know, even using growth charts for kids, you know, it's information. It's great information to have. I think it's important that we, you know, are watching a kid's growth curve, but it's not the only thing that matters. You know, there are so many things that go into what somebody's health status is, what their quality of life is, and, you know, the BMI and growth charts, they tell us one tiny bit of information, and we shouldn't be making medical decisions based off of that one piece of information.
Yeah. And one thing that happened in the early 90s was that they literally changed the rating. So overnight, millions of people were called obese or overweight that were not considered or categorized that the day before. Right. And so we see this data of this is such a big issue where so many people are obese now, or it's increasing. Well, they literally changed the scale.
Right, right. They created this quote unquote obesity epidemic overnight by recategorizing people. I mean, it really was this like huge flood. And I mean, that was right in like my heyday of like healthism and when I was really like into, you know, health and nutrition. And it really influenced me. And I you know, bought it all. And I think it was an unfortunate thing that has created more problems than it solved. And, you know, if we look at like human history, and I mean, especially recent history, like the way we react to things like this, there's always an extreme overcorrection that hurts a lot of people and doesn't necessarily solve the actual problem, quote unquote. Like if we look at the 80s, they're like, oh, there's a high fat problem. People are consuming too much fat. You know, this is the big problem. So then everything went low fat and we still saw, you know, the same level of those problems, you know, continue to increase at the same rates. So, and then they're like, oh, it's not fat. We take it back, you know, 20 years later.
Right.
So
right.
It's an evolving science. And I think to make these blanket statements like that, and, you know, and especially in things like that, where like they literally change something, one piece of information changed overnight, you know, that is astounding.
Can you talk a little bit about the work you do with kids, with children? I found it really interesting. I don't have kids, so I have no idea.
Well, and you know, it's interesting because when my daughter was born, we got help from Early Steps, which is an early intervention service. And it was speech therapy, occupational therapy, physical therapy, and special instruction. And they would come into our home and help us with these things that she needed to learn for daily living. And at the time, she had a feeding tube and we had to get, you know, we had to wean her from the feeding tube, get her to oral feeding. And I worked, you know, side by side with our speech therapist. And she's like, I wish I had a dietitian on every case. And I was like, yeah, Early Steps should really have a dietitian. And she's like, yeah, do you want to be one? And I was like, oh, okay. Yeah. So in the work that I do most days, I feel like a huge piece of it is helping parents calm their anxiety around the feeding issues, whatever they are. Typically it's not, you know, life and death or this huge struggle. It feels like it because it, you know, it is concerning when your child doesn't eat or can't eat. But for the most part, you know, we do see kids naturally making progress even before I'm there. It just depends on what's going on with them medically, where they are age-wise. A lot of it is helping parents with relaxing around mealtimes and just sitting back a little bit. I follow the Ellen Satter method, division of responsibility, where, you know, the parent decides what food is served, what time the food is served, and where. And then it's up to the child to decide if they're going to eat and how much they're going to eat. And it's really about kind of a hands-off approach of letting a child cultivate and become curious about food, where they can have this relationship that is natural and innate and intuitive, versus saying you have to eat this food and you have to eat this amount of food because, you know, that's what this paper from the doctor says, or that's what this book or this website says. It's more about letting kids be their own internal calculator of what they need, because I mean, essentially that's what most, you know, humans could and should do, you know, to really know what we need.
Yes.
And
it's practice. You know,
right, it is.
You know what you like or how much or what impact food has on you over time.
Mm-hmm. And kids are really good at knowing what they need and what they want. And I do find, you know, a lot of parents get concerned that, oh, my child only likes milk and carbohydrates and all these. And that's natural because they were born wanting to look for milk. Like their brain was like, where's the milk? You know, and that's also carbohydrates and sugar. And so when we're little, those are the things that our body is like attracted to and interested in. And it just makes sense. And we can continue to, you know, offer the broccoli, offer the proteins, but it might take them a while to accept those foods. And it's, you know, normal and natural. And I think, you know, for a lot of my parents that I work with, you know, they're dealing with other stressors and struggles because there are other things happening with that family. But I do see that a lot of trends, no matter what the child's diagnosis is, and then even with typical kids that I work with, there's a lot of the similar trends where some kids just need more time. Some kids just need more support.
What does time look like? Like you offer the meal that you have with the food you have in your kitchen and y'all all sit down, maybe that's how it works. And then that you just get, you have a set amount, you have a set dinner time, eating time.
Mm-hmm.
And then that happens every day.
Right. Yeah. I mean, essentially for kids, you know, they really need structure. You know, that's an important part of life for them. And you set the times and say, okay, breakfast will be served from 7:30 to 8:00. And if the meal's not eaten, then okay, you'll have another opportunity at snack time at 10:30, you know? And so kind of, and depending on the child's age, you know, there's a lot that goes into that decision. But essentially you always want to serve them food that you know that they'll eat at least one component. Like they've had it before. It's a preferred food. I mean, even if it is just their milk that, you know, okay, they're at least going to drink the milk. If they don't eat these, you know, the spaghetti and meatballs, you know, no big deal. A lot of times in my house, I do bread and butter because I know my 4-year-old will eat that. And if nothing else, she's going to get some calories.
Yeah. Yeah. My grandma always served us bread and butter. When we were sitting down at the table, there was always toast and butter.
That's
and
awesome.
Coffee, even as a little kid, obviously. Yeah. Always drank coffee milk with everything. That's funny. I'm trying to think of, I had some other questions, but I guess what are maybe some of, you had a ton of books and resources that you shared with us a couple weeks ago. Can you maybe share some of your favorite books to learn about the issues you've been talking about?
Yeah, I mean, I think the Intuitive Eating book was my number one kind of entryway. And that's something that I think is really important for people who do struggle with their relationship with food. I think that would be a great one. There was an original book in the 90s that I would not recommend because things have changed and evolved and the writers have recognized that. And so I definitely recommend the 4th edition. That's my number one. Anti-Diet by Christy Harrison is another big one. She really dives deep into the science around the wellness culture problems we have and how dieting is essentially like an industry and we are the best return customers, you know, because we're convinced that we can control our weight and we should, and that should be our number one goal.
Yeah. I mean, so much of what we do are the fixes that we see coming at us is because of shame that we feel about ourselves.
Right. Yeah. And then it's an individual personal problem and not a systemic worldview problem.
Yeah. I love Brené Brown. I'm assuming maybe you're interested too, but I feel like that's why her work has been so transformative for so many people in the last few years. It's like, oh shit, like I have a shame problem that I could look at And it can right. help me in all kinds yeah. of different ways.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Yeah. Any other books? You had also mentioned Health at Every, the book, there's a book Health at Every Size, right?
Right. And there was a rewrite and it's called Body Respect. And there's also a lot of science in there. They actually have a paper related to that where they kind of debunked a lot of the health stigma that is generally used in, or weight stigma that we see, you know, in medicine. And then Chrissy Harrison has a podcast that's really great too, by the way. Her podcast is called Food Psych. And that was, you know, one of the best probably teaching experiences for me was listening to her podcast. And then, you know, just talking about like shame and body image, things like that. More Than a Body by Lexi and Lindsay Kite. They talk about body image in a way that like I hadn't really heard it before. That really landed with me. They talk about the fact that our body is an instrument and not an object to be viewed. And I just really love that kind of language that I think it really lands. And of course they have studies and things like that where they really support what they teach. I'm reading a book called Decolonizing Wellness. That's my current read. I think that one's really important. It's for people who are people of color, queer. It's really written for them because so much of what's available to us in the nutrition and wellness world is written by thin white women because that's who dominates our profession. Yeah. And I think that it kind of has kept, there's a level of gatekeeping in the internship that's not really accessible to everybody. But that there's an expectation that, you know, kind of in the same world of like yoga teachers where like you have to look a certain way in order to be a part of this profession. And it's hard for us to speak to the experiences of people who, you know, we're not in their culture, we're not in their lifestyles, and we don't deal with the oppression they deal with on a daily basis. So it's really hard for us to like say, yeah, just go get 5 servings of fruits and vegetables a day and you'll be great, you know.
Yeah. Or like that certain foods are not good for you.
Right, yeah, eating the foods of your culture. I've had that, like I've had clients where they're like, oh, the pediatrician said we shouldn't feed her tortillas.
Yeah, tortillas. That was the one that
came to me. No, if your little girl, because then this is a little girl with feeding challenges who doesn't eat a lot. If she will eat tortillas, feed her all the tortillas.
Yeah.
Put some beef on it, put some beans, give her some extra calories.
Yeah, that part. Yeah. I just picked up the book Fearing the Black Body about the history. Yeah, another student had told me about that. And I guess it's the history of this conversation.
Right. It links, yeah, because I mean, the anti-fat conversations, the anti-fat cultural narrative we live under is based off of racism, you know? That's where it comes from. That one, and there's another one, I think it's one of my Kindle books, that Body of Truth. That dives into that as well. Harriet Brown. Belly of the Beast is a newer one. Deshaun Harrison wrote that one.
Cool, thank you. I'll link all those in the show notes. So that
I mean, they're just great places to start for sure.
Yeah. So we just have a few minutes left, but I wanted to, since you're a yoga teacher and in the class that we did the other week, you had us do this chair yoga, which was so good.
Yeah.
You really can feel good sitting in your chair doing these exercises. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering if you could just spend like one or two minutes going through, leading us, the listeners, like through a small little yoga set that we
sure.
can do while we're sitting.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Yeah. So yeah, just finding a nice stable seat. So a chair that, where when you press your feet into the floor, you can line your heels with your knees and your knees are in line with your hips, kind of creating 90-degree angles there. And then you're going to settle into your seat. Option to close your eyes if it feels good, or find something to bring your gaze to if your eyes are open. Allow your shoulders to be stacked directly above your hips. Lift the crown of your head towards the ceiling. And just breathe here, allowing your hands to rest where it feels natural. With your next inhale, gently lengthen your spine towards the ceiling. With your exhale, feel your shoulders soften down. Relax any tension you might feel in your jaw or brow. And just breathe here. With your next exhale, gently allow your chin to begin to drift towards your chest. Feeling a nice stretch through the back of your neck and just going as far as feels good for you. Keeping your shoulders stacked over your hips, seat rooted, feet grounded. Gently begin to bring your right ear towards your right shoulder. Take a moment with that, feeling that left side of your neck stretch and soften. Gently allow your chin to move back to the center of your chest. And then slowly, left ear comes to left shoulder. Staying rooted through your feet and your seat. Getting that nice gentle stretch through the right side of your neck. And then we're going to gently move to allowing your chin to come back through to your chest. And then right ear to right shoulder. And then just finding some gentle nods back and forth. Just getting a little bit more movement as you breathe. Option for a full neck revolution if that feels good for you, bringing your head back, facing the ceiling. We're going to do three more rounds. So feel free to go in the opposite direction for two of those. And then we'll meet chin to chest. Slowly begin to draw your gaze up. You can keep your eyes closed or open, whatever feels good for you. Settle into your seat again. Feel your feet. I'm going to do just a few cat-cows from the seated position. I like my hands on my thighs for this. And for cow, you're going to just open through your collarbones, drawing your shoulders back and down, maybe lifting your gaze up. With your exhale, you're going to curl it in, drawing your spine towards the back of the chair, chin to chest. Inhale, open up, cow. Exhaling for cat. Two more like that. Inhaling, open. Exhaling, drawing back. Last one. We'll meet back at center. Ground through your feet. Feel your seat rooted, shoulders softened back, crown lifted. Bring your hands by your sides, wiggle them out. And we're going to slowly find an inhale up. Fingertips reach to the sky. You can bring your gaze up if that feels okay for you. Lifting, finding length between your shoulders and your ears. Inhale, big breath in. Exhale, release. Arms come down. Shake it off again. And that's it.
Hey.
Short demo.
Thank you. That's so refreshing. I do my work when I have like a full day at a table with that 25 minute schedule. So I do 25 mm-hmm. minutes of work, usually longer than 10 minutes of doing whatever. And then where I'm allowed to check my phone or do something like that. And then another 20. And I just kind of do that. And then, and that has been super helpful in having some energy left at the end of the day, because you seem to just like go straight through and your brain just does, my brain does not work at the end of the day after that.
Yeah. I mean, and that's what I love about having a yoga practice is I'll take two or three poses and just do that in the middle of a day. Like, especially like sitting here for hours at a time, a forward fold is like the best medicine for me.
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes in that 10 minutes, I will get up and do some like regular stretches in the larger part of my living room. And then sometimes I'll put on a day, I'll put on Whitney Houston for those few minutes.
Yeah.
But it's helpful to have something, lined up in what you're going to do for a little break too.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. There's a great yoga teacher, Raina Cohen is one of my favorites. She has a YouTube channel and she does a lot of really little like 15, 20 minute yoga shorts. And she has a lot of great, you know, if your hips are tight, do this, you know, if your shoulders are tight, do that. So she's a great one and she's fat positive.
Yeah. Cool. Awesome. I'll put that in the show. I'll link that too.
Cool.
Thank you so much for talking to me. I really appreciate it. I really appreciate your time.
Yeah, no, I'm glad. I really like your podcast and I can't wait to hear the rest of the season.
Thanks. Awesome. Okay, I just wanted to mark the time.
That's good.
Yeah. All right. Thank you so much. So we'll just cut that piece out. I'm really sorry. That is
okay.
Obviously was what was going to happen.
Right. It had to go that way. But I mean, it's nice that you have the capability to edit and it wasn't like live. And I think I've said more things I wanted to say in the second one.
Okay. Anyway.
I got a dress rehearsal.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. That's awesome. Well, thank you so much. I will probably reach out to you again about with questions and other stuff later.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm down for it.
Cool. Thanks. Well, have a really great day. That's all for today. Thanks so much for listening to Making Good. You can find our podcast on all the platforms you find your favorite podcasts. You can also find a transcript of this episode and all of our episodes on our website, churchalley.store. If you loved this episode, please share it and let others know about the good work of Church Alley Cafe and Grocery. Thanks again for listening to Making Good. I hope you have a really good day. We'll see you next time.